Hello and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the events, policies and ideas that will shape the world for the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Mark Leonard. I'm director of ECFR. And this week's podcast is about the war in Gaza. Since we last discussed the war on the podcast in November, international opinion has shifted quite a bit. And much of the sympathy which Israel garnered following the October the 7th attacks has evaporated against the background of its continuing bombing of Gaza, where the death toll has now reached over 30,000. Now, the war has also reached a crucial tipping point. Israel is gearing up for a big offensive on Rafah, but all the while, the US and a group of Arab countries have been trying desperately to negotiate a ceasefire between the two sides. And as we record this episode, the negotiations hang in the balance. The hope is that amidst all the death and destruction, there may also be an opportunity to unblock the decades-long conflict between Israelis and Palestinians and pave the way towards a long-term sustainable peace in the region. Will this ceasefire happen? How will the war carry on playing out in the US and in Europe? What are the odds that we could end up with a grand bargain that results not just in a two-state solution, but a wider regional peace? Luckily, we got an all-star cast to help us make sense of this on the podcast. Coming back to podcast this week, we have Hugh Lovett, who is a senior policy fellow at ECFR and an expert on Israel-Palestine. Julian Barnes-Dacey, who is director of ECFR's Middle East and North Africa program. And Jeremy Shapiro, our research director, who is also the director of our new US program and a failed conspirator against the leadership of this podcast. But we are nevertheless inviting him back.
Oh, I thought that was my punishment.
Okay. Welcome, all of you, to the podcast. Let's start with the basics. Hugh, why don't you talk us through what the situation is on the ground at the moment?
All eyes are currently on Rafah. And so there's a big question about whether and when Israel will embark on what it's described as the third phase of its military operation in Gaza and go into Rafah, which is this border town on the Gazan-Egyptian border. For Israel, this is seen as a security necessity. Firstly, because given its proximity to the Egyptian border, this has been a major conduit for Hamas weapons smuggling. Israel also claims this is where the remnants of Hamas's leadership is based, and also with the Israeli hostages taken by Hamas on the 7th of October. There's question marks about whether an Israeli military operation would actually accomplish those goals that we can maybe go into later, but that's the security thinking. There's obviously also a political dynamic in Israel in terms of how a potential operation in Rafah fits into the domestic Israeli dynamics, and especially Prime Minister Netanyahu's effort to continue clinging to power despite his plummeting popularity ratings. But one of the questions about whether Israel does go in or not is very much predicated on the outcome of Hamas-Israel negotiations currently being mediated by Qatar, Egypt, and the United States. There was a hope that these negotiations could reach a ceasefire deal by the beginning of Ramadan, which is in 3 days' time on the 10th of March. That appears to be increasingly difficult to imagine happening. There's still a few days left to go, but the reports today out of Cairo, where there was another round of meetings, was that the current negotiations have ended without any final agreement. And there's two technical questions about exactly how many Israeli hostages would be released for how many Palestinian prisoners and for how long. But the bigger issue is, of course, what happens after the initial pause in fighting. So what happens after Hamas releases Israeli hostages? Hamas would like there to be a full ceasefire. Israel would like to go back on the offensive and to finish the job as it sees it against Hamas. Of course, and I'll finish on this point, we're talking politics here, but let's also remember there is an absolutely dire and catastrophic humanitarian situation, which is continuing to worsen amidst increasing alarm about the outbreak of famine, especially in northern Gaza.
Thank you very much, Hugh. So it'd be good to go into the details of the different baskets that you laid out. maybe, Jeremy, everyone's been looking at Washington from the beginning of the crisis, and we've had an increasingly fractious tone in American communications about it, as their attempts to influence Israel privately have failed to bear much fruit. Do you want to talk a bit about how Washington sees the situation at the moment, how optimistic they are at both coming up with a short-term solution and achieving something before Ramadan or shortly afterwards, before we go on to the sort of longer-term hopes for the region?
Yeah, they are reasonably optimistic, although I guess optimism is sort of a job requirement to work in a U.S. administration. I think that they're in general, they've set a sort of some sort of framework, I guess, for trying to work with Israel, which is, you know, has many questionable aspects to it, but it's what they've decided to do. I think in the first instance, they have really decided not to use most of the leverage that they have in terms of military assistance. This was a decision that was made quite early on, and it's limited their ability to influence the Israelis. That has something to do with the president's understanding of the nature of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, but also Israel's place in U.S. domestic politics, which has, even as there's been a lot of anti-Israel sentiment expressed in the U.S., there's still quite a strong pro-faction in U.S. politics. The second thing that they've decided to do, I think, is to, for a while at least, limit their intervention into Israeli domestic politics. They believe what they
have. There's an increasing number of people calling on Biden to mimic Netanyahu's interference in American domestic politics by going and talking to the Knesset and speaking over
exactly.
his head.
And there has been a lot of consideration of that within the administration, and they may actually get there. I don't think they're quite there yet. What they have decided to do in the interim is to sort of try to deliver for the Israelis a couple of things. First, some gains on hostages, and that's really what the ceasefire negotiations are about. Is about making sure that Israeli hostages come home, as well as providing humanitarian relief to the Palestinians. And the second thing is to help them in eliminating Hamas leadership, which they think that once there's progress on those two goals, they can start to pressure Israeli politics and they can start to work through or around Netanyahu as is necessary. And I think that you see the sort of opening salvo of that in the Gantz visit. But I think that, you know, they feel as if they need to have some developments on the ground and in the ceasefire negotiations before they can really do that. And so I'm a little bit confused as to what their timetables are. And the other end of it is that there is pressure from the political side of the House in the Biden administration that they want this thing, you know, not to get into the way of the general election. There's been some upset within the Democratic coalition and in the country. And I think they feel that that is manageable.
Michigan.
Yeah, I think they feel that is manageable. But probably if the war is still going on come summer and fall, it could become more serious. And so there is a sort of political clock to at least getting this thing off the front pages. And that is starting to bite, although I think they still have some more time on that.
Great. Thanks, Jeremy. So the other big actors in this are the regional actors. We're going to talk about the prospects for regional peace and how the Israel-Palestine topic connects to normalization and other dimensions of it. But obviously, Egypt, Qatar are very involved in the negotiations at the moment over hostages, over humanitarian access. Julian, how do you read the mood in the region?
So first and foremost, I think there's immense frustration, obviously, at what's happening, that we are 5 months into this conflict and that the levels of violence and killing haven't abated. There is, I think, a great deal of frustration with the US and its unwillingness to kind of press Netanyahu more forcefully in a sense that, as Jeremy says, that they haven't been willing to deploy their leverage. Clearly, you have a lot of public unrest and unhappiness, and that's being channeled by governments into a few different things. One is obviously the Qataris and the Egyptians, as you say, leaning in very hard to these negotiations to try and get a ceasefire. The other has been a kind of a growing attempt by Arab states to put together some kind of political plan that they could take to the warring parties, that they could take to the US to try and lay out a kind of a sustainable roadmap that could wedge open the space created by an initial ceasefire. But even then,
do you want to just say a word or two about what's in that?
So I think, look, it's still being put together by these five key Arab countries: the Jordanians, Egyptians, the Saudis, the Emiratis, and the Qataris. I think the basic core of it is, in a sense, quite well known. It harks back to the Arab peace plan, effectively offering Israel a pathway to regional normalization and integration in exchange for a recognition of the two-state solution. I think there's also some indications of a willingness to step up in terms of Arab efforts to support and reform the Palestinian political side of the house. There may be a willingness to even put some Arab peacekeepers on the ground to try and fill some of the security vacuum that emerges after this conflict, but you know, this is a plan that the broad contours have been out there for a long time, and even if there's some new energy and some new impetus in terms of trying to formulate that and put that on the table, I think there is an immense amount of pessimism in the region because of the sense that the Israelis in particular are more unwilling than ever to engage with a two-state track, and obviously the mood in Israel right now, the public mood, the political mood is very hostile to opening a conversation, a political conversation with the Palestinians. So getting the Israelis to move on that is, I think, a key point of frustration. They do think that they can get the Palestinians in line. I think they even think that they can get Hamas to concede on core elements. The other, I think, point of frustration is the fact that ultimately they think that this can only be delivered through U.S. leadership. You know, if you are going to get Israel to move, it's going to have to be via Washington. And for the reasons laid out by Jeremy, they just don't see that Washington is prepared to lean in there. And even if privately, you know, many in the administration may be sharing the sentiment of Arab states and wanting Israel to move in that direction, clearly President Biden is not in that same place, and there hasn't been a willingness to use that leverage. And I think everyone is very aware that there's a dangerous timeline here, not just in terms of the fact that the longer this conflict goes on the ground, the harder it will be to get a constructive solution out of it, but also that the political timetable in the US and Israel kind of moves against you at one point. Obviously, with the US election coming up, Biden is going to be less willing to engage, potentially scared of being outflanked by Trump on the kind of pro-Israeli line. And obviously Netanyahu can use or play Biden to score domestic points by positioning himself as a leader able to resist US pressure to move towards a two-state track. So, you know, there's this Arab plan, there's an urgency, a desire for movement, that they're perhaps prepared to commit more to it than they have in the past. But the core blockages are as acute as ever. And all eyes continue to be on DC in that regard.
So before we go back to DC, maybe Hugh, you can go a little bit deeper into this, because what Julian was talking about is essentially the idea that there will be no progress unless there's a change in the leadership on both the Israeli and the Palestinian sides, and more than the change in the leadership. We had the Prime Minister of Palestine resigning last week, but most people don't think that that's the sort of game-changing shift which will give Israel a partner for peace on the Palestinian side. And on the Israeli side, Netanyahu has now indicated in lots of different ways that he doesn't really see himself as a partner for peace. So what hope is there of changing those two realities?
Let's start with Israel first. There is a hope and an expectation that there will be a change of government. I have no doubt that at some point Netanyahu will be gone. The question is, when will that happen? How imminent is that? And I think that this is the problem. A, even if there were elections today, it will take, knowing how difficult the Israeli political system is and the protracted negotiations that go into forming a new governing coalition, we cannot expect a new government to be formed before the summer. Maybe I'm being a little bit too pessimistic, but certainly it would take at least a month or more. And of course, elections are not happening today. And I think this is the problem, is that how do you force Netanyahu from power? Netanyahu has obviously no desire to call elections because he will lose that. But at the same time, the core of his governing coalition remains relatively stable and intact. Even if some parties or some politicians, such as Benny Gantz, do leave, he'll still have a majority and he'll be able to continue governing until elections happen. So I think this is the problem. Now, potentially, there could be a increasing grassroots movement against him. And we saw this prior to October, when there was when Israel was witness to large-scale public demonstrations against the government because of changes it was bringing to curb the independence of the judiciary. So we could see this potentially restarting at some point, perhaps also energized by Israeli soldiers who have been demobilized and their own anger at what they would perhaps see as the lack of direction that the Israeli government has and the lack of prioritization of releasing hostages. So all those dynamics are kind of there, but it's still difficult to see those dynamics coming together so long as there's a war in Gaza. And Netanyahu knows that. On the Palestinian side,
isn't that the point that many people in Israel say that what happened is not really like 9/11? It's a much bigger change than that in terms of how Israel sees itself. It's more like the collapse of the Berlin Wall or something like that. It's something that really changes Israeli identity and does mean that all of the ideas that we've been discussing about a two-state solution and just seem to cut completely against the grain of where most Israelis are at the moment in terms of their ideas of security and what is going to be livable in the future.
I think that's absolutely true. And the violence and the atrocities on the 7th of October were, of course, hugely and deeply traumatic for Israel. Now, that will do little to sustain Netanyahu's political life. In anything, I think that will hasten it once the war is over. But when it comes to the broader strategic questions about where does Israel go next, to me, and it's easy to say as someone who's not Israeli, one would hope that the lesson would be that Israel cannot continue to live by the sword, that continuing conflict, continuing occupation will only breed further insecurity and further violence. Now, I think for many Israelis that the lesson is somewhat opposite, which is that making peace with Palestinians, withdrawing control over the Palestinian territories, all those things are more dangerous now. And the events in October have demonstrated that. So Israel needs a new security model, but one that is perhaps predicated on a better and more effective control of Palestinians. Now, again, maybe this is me being pessimistic. Maybe these things will change in the future. But certainly as they stand today, it is difficult to really find much of a constituency that would be eager to push for a real two-state solution, which would mean Palestinian self-determination and ending the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza.
Does that mean, Hugh, that basically kind of it doesn't really matter if there's a new election or a new leader? They're all going to push in the same direction. I mean, there's all this talk about a post-Netanyahu government, but I take it that the core point being we can talk to Gantz, we can talk to Lapid or whatever, but in the end, the government policy vis-a-vis the Palestinians, if not domestic stuff, will essentially stay the same.
Indeed. And I think there's a danger of thinking that everything that is bad is the fault of Netanyahu. And certainly as Israel's longest serving prime minister, Netanyahu has done much to forge Israel's current political and security identity, I would say. But nevertheless, the positions that he espouses are also positions that are, to a certain extent, also adopted by parties, by political parties to his left. So in terms of how do you, I mean, put it in concrete terms, who in the Israeli political system supports a two-state solution based on international parameters at the moment? Outside of Meretz, the very dovish left-wing party, maybe parts of the Israeli Labour Party, which is currently falling below the threshold of entering the Knesset, there really isn't that kind of constituency. Now, again, that could be that could change. We've seen it in the past, but this is perhaps one of the challenges when we're talking about trying to restart a political track, an Israeli-Palestinian political track, is that, you know, it will take a long time to recreate positive dynamics to enable that within Israel. And again, there's also the question of the Palestinian side.
Yeah, I was about to say, you've kind of shown how the Israeli side is almost insuperable. On the Palestinian side, it's not much easier because... given what you said about the Israelis, the appetite to have a unified leadership, which will include, you know, elements that are seen beyond the pale, such as, you know, at least people who can talk to Hamas and the administrative bits of it, you know, what chances are there of that happening? Mm-mm.
And I think on the Palestinian side, it's a slightly different problem and a different dynamic. At a public level, yes, you do see a considerable rise in support for what Palestinians would call armed resistance. But at the same time, when you sort of probe their political attitudes, there still is a large support for a two-state solution. Now that shifts. There's been an increase in support for one state, but it's, as far as my understanding is that this is a pragmatic determination that Palestinians will support any model that actually delivers real change for them, which includes ending the occupation. So I think the public opinion is not my biggest concern. The biggest issue is, of course, that you do not have a coherent, unified, and representative and legitimate Palestinian leadership that can actually go into negotiations with Israel, because ultimately this will require negotiations with Israel, that can go into this, make an agreement that will require Palestinian concessions, including the borders and the right of return for Palestinian refugees, not only make these concessions, but then be able to ensure broad-based public and political buy-in to make that happen.
So we're running out of time. Is there a name that could do that, like Marwan Barghouti or somebody like that?
Yeah, well, I think someone like Marwan Barghouti, you know, is someone who is seen by Palestinians as a more of a unifying figure that does have the political credibility to be able to perhaps to make the case for Palestinians in terms of why they need to re-enter negotiations. But it would have to be on a slightly different political basis that we don't have time to talk about now. But I do think that is perhaps one of the better options. But ultimately, let me finish on this point. It's not about people, it's about institutions. So yes, you need the right leaders, but you also need to invest in recreating independent and credible Palestinian national institutions.
So the Israel-Palestine situation hasn't really moved in a positive direction since the 7th of October. That is a contrast with the regional situation, which has been moving for a while in a more positive direction. And that's part of the paradox of where we're at the moment. Julian, how do you, because, you know, when we talk to people from the Gulf, whether it's Saudis or Emiratis or other players, they are still very keen to push forward a different diplomatic setup in the region. They're very conscious of how mobilized public opinion has been by the horrifying images that come out of Gaza. But at the same time, their preference is to try and move towards mobilization and to go for a sort of grand bargain. How do they get around the paradox that we've just described?
Well, I mean, I'd probably disagree slightly, Mark, in the sense that yeah, there's that underlying desire for regional detente, and the Saudis and the Iranians are talking more closely than ever, and they're focused on a grand bargain and the economy. But you know, the immediate concern of most of these states is still the risk of kind of escalation tied to the war in Gaza. I mean, the Lebanon-Israeli border remains very hot. The Houthis are continuing to send missiles into the Red Sea and killing people in so doing. Militias in Iraq and Syria, I think just today, have announced that they're going to resume attacks, if not on U.S. forces, at least in an attempt to strike Israel. So all of these are very delicate, fragile, points that still risk a wider regional explosion. There's a strong sentiment within the Israeli security establishment that feels you need a more forceful Israeli response against Hezbollah in Lebanon. The U.S. presence across the region does make them vulnerable and threatens the risk of a more direct U.S.-Iranian conflict. So these are the concerns. In fact, we've just launched a new web mapping project identifying these different regional hotspots that one can access on the ECFR website. But these are, you know, driving regional concerns as much as anything. Sure, the Saudis and the Iranians are talking to each other. The Arabs are prepared to put this peace plan in front of the Israelis. And interestingly enough, unlike in previous years, they feel the need to have Iran as part of the mix. There's a lot of thinking going on in the Arab side of saying, well, you know, Iran is not going to be a direct partner, but they can't be a blocker. They can't be a spoiler. And the Saudis are thinking about how you keep them in the box so that they don't spoil everything, given their links to Hamas and Hezbollah and so forth. But the basic idea is that regional plan for a more constructive, inclusive future built on interlinkages and connections can't really go forward when you have this kind of conflict at the heart of the region and when you have this day-to-day kind of risk of broader escalation.
And that's the big hope in terms of getting this ceasefire, which would allow us to move away from the fear of widening and deepening escalating of the conflict.
But just worth saying on that, I mean, the 1 week we had a ceasefire in November, there was a regional pause. But there's a real risk that all of these other regional dynamics have assumed a life of their own now. You know, will the Houthis rein it in when they see the leverage they've accrued? Will the Iraqi militias stop the attacks when they feel that they can get the Americans out of Iraq now? So, yes, we need a ceasefire in Gaza, and that has to be the starting point. But because we've left it so long, it's going to be much harder to roll everything back in at this stage.
So that all brings us back to the US, which has traditionally been the kind of guarantor of peace and security in the whole region with dramatically successful effects over the last 15 to 20 years in particular. Bleak humorous.
I feel like you need a sarcasm alert, Mark, for the podcast. If not, people aren't going to get that.
Okay, so bleak humor aside. So, Jeremy, all eyes in the Middle East usually end up returning to Washington, which has been a guarantor for security in the region for the last few decades with mixed levels of success. How do American strategists think about how they can help to put the conflict back in a box and to stop it from escalating further and creating a sort of nightmare regional conflict that Julian was describing?
Yeah, I mean, they have a not too different plan than the Arab regional actors. Frankly, that's why they're behind a lot of what the Arab regional actors are doing. They have in the first instance tried to establish a very strong deterrent effort against regional escalation, which has been in the Iran case fairly successful, in the Houthi case much less successful, but they're still pushing at that element, and they do feel like they can get control of the Houthi situation. In the second instance, what they're trying to do is advance the same old Arab regional sponsored two-state solution peace plan that Julian and Hugh were describing, that is which involves finding a Palestinian negotiating partner, strong arming Israeli politics, and then getting the regional states to create connectivity and recognition of Israel and all that stuff, which is it sounds fine, and obviously it has regional buy-in, which is nice. It's just that it's the plan that we've been trying, that the region has been trying, and that the U.S. has been trying for a long time. And I think, there's all sorts of reasons for blaming both of them for why it's worked, not why it hasn't worked. But I would still submit that the fundamental reasons are the Israelis and the Palestinians, neither of whom really seem to want it. And it does seem to me that the atrocities of October 7th and the horrors of the Gaza war have not really increased that desire on either side. So sometimes I wonder why the outside parties are still adopting the same policy that they've had for pushing 20 or 30 years.
But Jeremy, I mean, just the unwillingness to lean more in with the Israelis and use leverage, is that a kind of a Biden issue, as some people are saying, very wrapped up in his personal view, or is that a kind of broader US administration position at the moment? Because that does seem to be one of the key dimensions here. I mean, the Arabs are saying, we can bring the Palestinians to the table on this. We will impose this on them. Why are the Americans
nobody believes that. I think the question of leverage and whether to use it is a very fraught one. There are certainly lots of disagreements within the administration. Biden is on one side of that, but he is not alone. And I think that there is a serious question, which I think, you know, should be engaged as to whether this leverage would really work if it was deployed. And there's two sort of broad reasons to think why it might not be all that effective. The first is that it's not clear how much the Israelis need this military aid. They obviously want it, and it's useful, but they're probably not willing to adjust core elements of their policy for it. The second is that it's not clear within U.S. domestic politics whether an administration would really succeed at using the leverage so boldly. They would probably prefer not to engage that. And that is, you know, that is, of course, an American issue, but it's an issue which is beyond the administration. And so I think Biden is very acutely aware from his experience of the congressional dynamics around Israel. And so he wonders, and I think Mark alluded to this, whether that would be politically savvy. Obviously, there is another side to this issue in U.S. politics, where there is a lot of support for ceasefires and ending the humanitarian disasters that are going on. But that doesn't mean that you don't have to be wary about the other side of the politics.
We've gone over time already, and we haven't mentioned Europeans yet, partly because they're not the central actors in a lot of these things. But there are a lot of European governments that are dealing with the fallout from the horrific situation in Gaza in their domestic politics, and putting money into supporting UNRWA and humanitarian aid to the population, as well as showing sympathy for Israelis and for other people who have been affected by the crisis. We should probably do a separate podcast on the European role, but Hugh, do you want to just say very quickly what the main activities of Europeans are and how they fit into the bigger picture?
Yeah. As you said, Mark, I think the Europeans are once again largely self-marginalizing, so that they do have an important role to play, and we at ECFR, you know, continue to push for this role. Yet it's quite clear through their actions that they continuously defer to either the Arab world and but also more often to the US for that leadership role. That's the first point. The second point is, as ever, and this is an evergreen topic, is EU divisions, and including it specifically, let's call them by name, the Hungarians, who continue to block just about every single thing related to Israel-Palestine, so you cannot get an EU agreement to do anything. Third point is, there is nevertheless a lot of activity, a lot of desire in European capitals to be active on this issue. And for once, there's an alignment of what I would call politics and policy. So it's good politics to be now active and engaged. And there's also a lot of policy things that can actually be done within that scope. And my last point, though, is I think there's still a lot of there's a lack of coordination between European capitals. So everyone wants to do something, everyone is doing something, but the capitals are not necessarily coordinating between themselves. And there isn't yet really, in my view, a strategic order of prioritization in terms of what everyone should be focusing on. So you have different capitals doing different things, not talking to themselves. So there is a unique moment for Europe to be doing something, to be actually pushing forward, not just the humanitarian track, but also the political track. But as ever, it's a question of unity and coordination and prioritization.
And there are cards. I mean, it should be, you know, the importance of paying into UNRWA at the moment, which is critical for the humanitarian situation, the importance of keeping Palestinian institutions functioning, using the political and economic relationship with Israel, tying all of that to the Arab peace plan, the question of recognition of Palestine and how that links into the potential plan. I mean, there are things to play with, to say the least. I mean, I think Hugh has conceptualized kind of the approach, but there are also kind of immediate things that are needed to be done, and I'd point particularly to the humanitarian and the UNRWA situation, and there are broader political cards that can be used.
So let's have a separate podcast looking at Europeans and what we can do to help. But there's one thing left to do on this podcast, and that is our bookshelf segment. What's on your bookshelf at the moment, Jeremy?
Unfortunately, the book that's on my bookshelf is still the same one as in the last podcast, which is Christopher Andrews' The History of Intelligence, The Secret World. So I would recommend, I guess, this time a politically themed television show that I've been watching, which is part of my descent into South Korean popular culture, which is a romantic North Korean, South Korean show about called Crash Landing on You, which is about a South Korean heiress who has a hang gliding accident that puts her in North Korea, and she falls in love with a North Korean military officer. It is very true to life, and I think really gives you a lot of insight into North Korean culture, so I would really recommend it.
I'd love to know how you know it's true to life, but maybe that's for another podcast. Julian, what's on your bookshelf for the moment?
I'm rereading The Imperfectionists by Tom Ruckman, which is a really great book about a kind of decaying international newspaper based in Rome, told through the lives of these kind of 10 different characters that make up the newspaper. And it's a really great evocative read that I first picked up about kind of 10 years ago. And last night I delved back in.
That's one of my favorite books ever.
It's a great book.
How about you, Hugh?
I'm afraid I'm going to be very predictable. And so I am currently rereading a book on Gaza by Jean-Pierre Filieu called Gaza, A History, which is very, I think, very good also for trying to contextualize what's happening today in Gaza.
Fantastic. We'll put links up to all the publications we mentioned, including the mapping of the battle lines in the Middle East, which Julian and Hugh and other colleagues on our Middle East and North Africa program have put together, which is fantastic and really worth looking at. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please head to whatever platform you use to download this episode and subscribe to future episodes. And while you're there, it would be wonderful if you could give us a positive review and a 5-star rating. But for now, from Jeremy Shapiro, Hugh Lovett, Julian Barnes-Dacey, and myself, Mark Leonard, it's goodbye. The researcher of this podcast is Anand Sundar, and our editor is Mireya Farrow-Saratz.